All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Johnson, Judge Riley, the Honorable Kevin Ross presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this July 17 panel. We have six cases on our calendar this morning, three of which are to be heard in oral argument and three of which we will consider on the briefs alone. The first case on for oral argument this morning, see if I can pronounce this right. Whoops, I have the wrong order. Is it Luong V. Ho? Am I pronounce that?
It's Aaron D.
Luong. So it's D. Luong versus Ho. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for a rebuttal. Those restrictions are indicated in the podium. We have a light and a clock. Pretty self-explanatory. Red light means you should have stopped by then. The floor is not going to drop open or anything, but please be mindful of those restrictions. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we keep track of the arguments in our audio recording of things. So, appellant's counsel, whenever you are ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Gray. I'm attorney for the appellant Aaron D. Luong. In our brief, we raised three issues. The question of whether the court properly decided the matter of spousal maintenance, whether it properly determined that the respondent's retirement account was totally non-marital, wholly non-marital, and whether the record supports the award of attorney's fees assessed by the court payable by the appellant to the respondent.
Am I correct that you're not challenging the fact findings of the district court as to expenses, reasonable expenses, and income of the parties?
Not the income, but the expenses I believe we are attacking in the sense that the trial court determined that after a 19-year marriage, respondent, wife, had reasonable expenses of $2,900, and the appellant husband had $1,700 in reasonable expenses. And considering that the wife hadn't worked in 2 years and they were living presumably on the appellant's income, it doesn't seem reasonable to have total expenses in excess of his net income.
I mean, as far as the math goes, I didn't see any argument that you're saying the district court clearly erred in its fact-finding in determining the expense, reasonable expenses.
No. No, I didn't. There's nothing in the brief about that, Your Honor. So an award of spousal maintenance should be based on the need of one party matched against the ability of the other party. In this case, the court awarded the respondent wife a sum of spousal maintenance that exceeds my client's income. He has $900 a month left after his net income, after paying child support and a medical assistance reimbursement. What the trial court said basically is that he has to pay more in spousal maintenance than he has available to him.
There's some precedent to support that, isn't there? District court to follow this sort of shared paying approach where neither party can meet his and her expenses. And so sort of equalizing the deficit.
Right.
Now, there is precedent for that, isn't there?
I agree. The question is, when does the sharing become too much? I believe that in this case, the trial court divided the total income of the parties available after payment of child support, and of course the wife doesn't have income. But what the trial court did is it awarded the wife 58% of my client's income, because he's got the only income, and it awarded him 42%. And I don't understand the logic of that. I understand the court can go somewhat over, but 58 to 42 seems like it's not Not the sharing anticipated by the case law, and I don't think the statute itself would allow it, but I understand the case law says there can be some sharing, that the ability and need don't have to be perfectly matched. I understand that. But in this case, I think the trial court went too far with the sharing that he did, and I think the pain is felt much more by the appellant than by the respondent. When she gets $1,300 to live on, and he gets less than, I don't know what that is, but it's a very small amount that he has available.
I was a little confused by your standard of review when we're reviewing this particular issue, and so could you tell me what you think the standard of review is?
Well, I believe it's based on an abuse of discretion under the mayor's case, Your Honor.
That's okay.
And
to Judge Ross's point, you don't say that any of the findings are clearly erroneous. It's just that the judge abused his discretion in how he apportioned the
correct
pain.
Correct. That's our argument, Your Honor.
Given the fact that this court has authorized, not required it, but authorized the district court by affirming, as within the district court's discretion, this sort of shared pain approach, regardless of whether it feels like it's fair or unfair, what is the rule of law that you would ask us to apply to draw the line between sharing of the pain obligation that exceeds the district court's discretion and one that falls within the district court's discretion?
Well, certainly there's people with more wisdom than me on the possible answers to that question, Your Honor, but I think that I don't think the trial court has unlimited discretion in the way it shares the pain, so to speak, and I think this court needs to look at case law, other cases, and decide whether this comports. Did the trial court look at other cases to say 5842 in one other case was an adequate way of dealing with the question of sharing? I don't have a case that says that 58.
But what would our holding be? And if we're going to establish if we're going to say the district court stepped outside of its discretion, we've got to draw the line somewhere. Is it a mathematical formula you're asking for?
I apologize, is it what?
Is it a mathematical formula that you're asking for when we draw the line, or is there some kind of legal principle that we should apply? What exactly? I don't think your brief lays it out for us. What are you asking us to do?
I absolutely didn't, Your Honor, but I think that it's like beauty's in the eye of the beholder. I don't have a bright line that I can draw for the court. I think that when you look at the facts of this case, when you look at a 19-year marriage where the wife made $70,000 a year until 2 years before the dissolution, and my client made working two jobs during the marriage, I believe made somewhat less than that, I think the equities would require the court look at the past history of the parties, the present circumstances.
Well, the court would look at the past. I mean, the past history isn't the current history, though, because in the past, both parties were able to work meaningfully, substantially, contributing to the income of the family. But now, and I know that's you're challenging the district court's disability sort of finding, but if it's true that there was evidence to support the district court's conclusion that of an inability, a current inability to work, then why would we look at past circumstances rather than the current circumstances?
Well, because the standard of living of the marriage, the way the parties live, they don't have any significant savings to fall back on with the wife's supposed illness. In terms of whether or not I have language that this court could or should use in terms of the bright line, I don't, but I just think that
I'm not looking necessarily for a bright line. Just do you have some sort of principle that we could articulate, a formula? It seems to me that you're asking us to say that district court has exceeded its discretion in an area where we haven't said that before. So we're going to have to distinguish between those cases that we've written in the past.
Right.
And this one, and I'm not sure how we can do that principally.
I haven't found a case, maybe the court is aware of one, where the division of the available income was 58% to one party and 42% to the other. That's my analysis of what the court did here. If there's a case that goes beyond that, then I've made a gross error in not finding that case. But I don't believe there is a case that went that far in terms of that split.
So if you're focusing on the math, give us an idea of where you think the math, where that number falls, where the dish is. It 50-50? Is it 45-55 the other way?
I think 55-45 would possibly meet the be within the judge's discretion.
That's only 3%.
I'm sorry?
That's only slightly different than 58-42. Or are you saying 55 in favor of your client?
No, 55 in favor of the 55-45 sharing, not 58-42.
Okay.
And that's just off the top of my
head. So
it's
not, I just want to be clear. Are you saying that, going to Judge Johnson's question, that 58% going to the obligee is too much, 55% going to the obligee would be within the court's discretion?
I didn't really have time to formulate an answer.
You're only talking about
3%
difference.
I don't know that. It's to me, 58-42 is unfair. So again, you want me to repeat my name, Mark Gray, for my second argument?
No, I meant just for each time you come to the podium.
Oh, I see. I thought you meant each argument.
No.
Sorry. Oh, you mean my...
We haven't forgotten you.
Okay. I know you haven't, but for the record, thank you. So the trial court's determination that the respondent is disabled from working seems to me based on very flimsy evidence. Doctor's notes, the doctor didn't testify, no sworn testimony. I don't know. Everyone gets headaches. Everyone has stomach aches. And at what point do the cumulative minor ills result in the permanent disability?
Was there evidence to the contrary? Did your client introduce evidence to establish ability to work?
I believe that he did not introduce evidence other than a 10-year or so history of making $70,000 a year at a sitting job, basically, working.
Right, before the illness. Before being hospitalized.
Right, before the quote-unquote illness.
It's not a quote-unquote hospitalization.
There was no major hospitalization that resulted in her being disabled. She didn't apply for Social Security disability.
There was evidence that was presented showing her inability to work. Why isn't that enough for the district court to rely on if your client introduced no contrary evidence or testimony?
I think the district court still has to make an analysis of the credibility of her own doctor and an unsworn affidavit, just doctor's notes that repeat what she told the doctor, at least apparently. I agree that appellant's counsel didn't adequately litigate the matter, but the trial court still has to have credible evidence that there is a disability here, that she's disabled.
Well, there's testimony.
I'm sorry?
You say credible evidence. The district court is entitled to believe testimony, and if there was testimony as to ongoing pain, various medical conditions, numbness, inability to complete a training program to help her return to work, why wouldn't that be a basis for the district court to? I understand it's not a lot of evidence, and I might be less inclined to be hesitant about it. Your argument would be more compelling had there been evidence presented on the other side of the balance. But when it's a preponderance of the evidence, and there's some evidence on the scale going one way, why isn't that enough?
I think doctor's notes, again, repeating what she told her doctor, and gastrointestinal problems and headaches for which the frequency, I don't believe, was mentioned in the record. Just, I have gastrointestinal issues, I have headaches, I have pain. And I don't think that's adequate for the court to say she's disabled from working, especially when there's no testimony, there's no evidence that she applied for what's called Social Security disability, which is very common. It's not often granted, I understand that. But when one feels one is disabled from working, and one has worked enough quarters, one does at least start the process of making a request or a claim with Social Security that they are disabled from working.
Was there any request for discovery on this issue, an independent medical examination, or
no
effort by your client to find evidence to present?
No, not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Then the trial court improperly based its award in part on prospective job opportunities when the statute says look at the foregone opportunities for employment by the obligee. So that was a clear error on the part of the court to say she will not have opportunities in the future when the statute says look at the past opportunities.
I thought the court said that at the time, for the time being. I didn't get a sense that the court was making a finding that she will never be able to work, but right now it appears that she's not able to work. It didn't seem that there was anything that would prohibit your client from, in a later proceeding, if there's evidence that is discovered that would show that now she's, her condition has changed and she's able to work, that there can't be a modification.
Well, although he didn't say she's permanently disabled from working, he did say she's disabled from working, which is tantamount to the same thing. It would apparently put the burden on my client in the future to prove she is of it. She's not disabled from working. See, he says within that finding that respondent wife will not be able to contribute in the future to her retirement account as a reason for awarding her spousal maintenance. But then the trial court states the appellant will continue to be able to build his retirement account if he so chooses. How in the name of anything can Mr. Luong contribute a nickel to a retirement account with what he's facing with this decree in terms of his spousal maintenance and his child support obligations, out-of-pocket medical expenses and things like that? It's just Pollyanna to say he'll be able to contribute to a retirement account and she won't, and that's a reason to award her spousal maintenance.
Thank you, Mr. Gray. Your time has expired.
Thank
you. Will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you choose to make an additional argument. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Lee Novelli. I represent Ms. Ho. I agree with opposing counsel regarding the three issues that were briefed for today. The first that I will address is the spousal maintenance issue. I agree that the standard of review is the abuse of discretion. I do family law at the district court level, and this decree couldn't be more detailed on the findings of fact for the party's income, expenses, and also a very good explanation of the sharing of the pain approach that the court took in awarding spousal maintenance. I mean, we don't often get judges who are this detailed, which is helpful to us. So I don't think that any of the findings can be challenged. They're clearly all supported by the record. The court had a lot of evidence regarding income and expenses. With regard to husband's budget, it was the budget he submitted. I mean, it was his own evidence that he's essentially contesting today. The court adjusted it because he testified that two of the expenses were paid for by his mother.
Going to the heart of the legal argument, is the district court's discretion boundless when it comes to this occasional holding of or decision of the sharing the pain when it comes to maintenance, where neither party, where the obligor, potential obligor, can meet his or her expenses and the potential obligee cannot, but there's not sufficient funds to cover all of the expenses. We've had these cases where there's an allowance for this approach, but is the district court's discretion boundless?
I don't believe it's boundless. I don't think anything's boundless.
So what are the bounds? I mean, if 58%, the argument is, first of all, do you agree with the math that Mr. Gray presents, that his client gets to keep 42% of his income and your client gets 58% of his income?
Yeah, I think the math is accurate. I think what the analysis the court needs to do is to look and see if the sharing of the pain is reasonable. What Mr. Gray didn't discuss and what hasn't been discussed on this issue is you have to look at the party's expenses. What are they? In this case, and I think as with a lot of family law issues, you have to look at the facts of the family. This wife was parenting three children almost on her own. Husband has 2 hours a week of parenting time with the children. That's it. It might have even been every other week. I apologize. I can't remember if it was every week or every other week. But all the rest of the time, the three children were with wife. She was paying literally all of their expenses, medical care, food, gas, everything. And so a lot of the reasons that her budget are reasonable and that it exceeds Mr. Long's budget is because a lot of the expenses that she's incurring are to maintain the household for these three children.
Well, the court didn't analyze it that way, but just decided mm-hmm. what's reasonable and what's not, and it determined your client has a certain amount of reasonable expenses, and Abel Gore has a certain amount of reasonable expenses.
But I think
and
there
so
was
if
a great...
If they're all reasonable, if all these expenses are reasonable, these are real expenses that the parties have,
mm-hmm.
Help us to understand what you think is a principled way to approach the district court's line of discretion. How much is too much when it comes to this sharing the pain approach?
I don't think there can be a bright. I mean, I don't think that there's a percentage that you can say if it goes over this percentage, it's too much. I think it depends on the family and the facts. And what I think the court was doing was prioritizing the household where the children were to ensure that those expenses could get paid to a higher degree than.
Well, the district court didn't do. I mean, the district court made this a permanent spousal maintenance award, mm-hmm. not based upon the location of the children. But based upon the needs of the parties.
Well, the child support will drop out when the children emancipate and husband will no longer have a share the pain argument. The percentages will change. So I do think the court was incorporating the needs of the children into the award. And I think it should have, because maintaining this household for those three children should be a priority. Did the court say that explicitly? No, but I think that that's inherent in the court's decision. And I think as you analyze the share the pain approach, I think that that is a reasonable factor to take into account as you look at the priority of these two parties' expenses, which is essentially what the court was doing.
Can I take you to the attorney fee mm-hmm. issue?
Yeah.
So the statute allows for need-based attorney's fees if a couple of elements are met, and there's a parallel to them. One of them is that one party has the means to pay, and the other party does not have the means to pay.
Mm-hmm.
So the district court decided that your client does not have the means to pay because she lacked an income.
And assets, I would argue.
Pardon me?
And liquid assets to pay for the fees.
Right. But we have I'm trying to get a sense of how it is. I haven't found a case like this one where the district court says, neither party can afford the attorney's fees out of income. So someone's going to have to pay it out of property. So how is it that if it has to come out of her property, she lacks the means to pay, but he has the means to pay by taking it out of his property?
I think this is similar to the share of the pain that the court's analysis that he did in spousal maintenance. She didn't have liquidity. I mean, all of her assets, if you will, were tied up in retirement and the equity in the home. The parties didn't have a whole lot of liquid assets to divide, I think almost any. And so I think what the court said is she's going to have to liquidate her assets to pay the property equalizer. And it is reasonable to reduce that obligation to allow her to afford fees. And he can afford that because he's already going to receive cash from her. So it's a...
He's going to receive cash from her mm-hmm. in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like neither party has the cash on hand to pay the attorney's fees,
mm-hmm.
And so the attorney's fees are, the attorney has to wait anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lost as to the, how this is a sharing of the pain. It seems as if it is taking the pain from one and putting it entirely in the other when neither of them can afford the attorney fees.
Well, I mean,
let me ask you this way. Have you seen any other case like this one where the obligor is deemed to have the means to pay out of a property, exclusively out of the property settlement when there is
not.
No income?
Yeah, I looked through the case law. I couldn't find any. I mean, either way, that the court, I don't think it's come up before. But I will say that the statute doesn't require that the parties fund the attorney fee award through income. I mean, I think the court is permitted to adjust the equities in the property division in order to allow one party to afford fees. This was a difficult case, I think. And part of what the judge was also doing was noting that the attorneys, in order for her to assert her rights, she had to go to great lengths to do so because of the difficulties she encountered from husband's behavior. And while this wasn't a need-based award, I do think that it went into the court's analysis and whether she could afford to assert those good faith rights because she had to go.
It seems those are two separate buckets. You've got the need-based and you've got the conduct-based.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the court did not apply the conduct-based fees.
Yeah, I mean, the court specifically said, I'm not going to reach the issue of conduct-based. He didn't deny it. He just said, I'm not going to rule on it because I've already awarded the fees through the need-based award. What the court would have done, I don't know. But I do think that in analyzing the good faith assertion of rights, he was taking into account the weighty level of wife's fees in order to get the evidence that she needed to prove the legal claims that could have easily been provided by husband. I mean, attached to the attorney fee affidavit are all the subpoenas that had to be sent because he wouldn't provide almost any bank statements, credit card statements. I mean, just very basic financial information that you usually get in a divorce. But
So how is he more able to pay the fees than she?
Essentially, because he's the one getting all the liquidity in the divorce. I mean, she is going to be required to take non-liquid assets, probably equity in the home, I would assume, or take on debt in order to pay him a property equalizer. There's no cash to pay. I mean, she's going to have to either liquidate retirement, take on debt, or take equity out of the marital homestead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
So I think what the court was doing was balancing. I mean, she's not getting any liquidity in the assets. He's going to get a relatively large cash payment through the property equalizer. And so I think it's reasonable for the court to say, you know, I'm going to reduce that debt burden on her to allow her to apply that debt to her attorney's fees. And he can afford it because he's just going to get slightly less cash.
When does the equalizer remind me when the equalizer needs to be paid by?
So the court did a sequestration. So it's when the children emancipate, when his child support obligation is no longer due.
And the youngest was 9 at the time of trial, right?
That's correct, I think.
Did the court assign interest on the delayed equalizer payment?
The court did not. Not that I recall.
That's unusual, isn't it? Isn't there a requirement if you're going to prevent a person from receiving the equalizer immediately, the property immediately, if there's a delay, isn't there an obligation to impose a interest?
I don't think there's an obligation to impose it. I think it's something that husband could have requested. I think given these facts, I mean, the basis for the request for sequestration was husband's own behavior. And so, but for his failure to meet almost any of his support obligations prior to trial and his ongoing gambling activity, if not addiction, it was his own behavior. I don't think he should benefit from interest in having the delay when he caused it.
Well, the issue of interest hasn't come up. I just was asking the question because of the, I'm having a hard time feeling that this meets the statute. It's the means to pay is the language the current statute uses.
I hear the struggle. I mean, I...
If she doesn't have the means to pay because she has to carve into her... she would otherwise have to carve into her property and liquidate things. So I don't see how it's any different as to him to say, well, he's got the cash on hand so he can pay it. It still comes out of the property settlement.
Well, and from that perspective, they both have an equal ability to pay her attorney's fees.
An equal inability to pay, actually,
yeah,
I think.
I would agree, which is similar to the equally...
But isn't that the problem? The statute says you can only require one to pay if that party has the means and the other one doesn't. So if the district court is going to say she doesn't have the means to pay because it's going to carve into her property, then it would seem that he also doesn't have the means to pay and it would fall short of the statute. On the other hand, if the district court is saying, no, he does have the means to pay because it's in his property, well, then she also would have the means to pay.
I don't think that they're equally unable to pay it through cash flow, through income. And they're in a similar position that they would each have to pay it. They would either have to take on debt or liquidate assets. So I think they're in a similar position.
Exactly, that's my point.
I agree.
They're either in the equal position of ability to pay, mm-hmm. which would mean the statute doesn't apply, or they're in the equal inability to pay, which would they, in other words, they lack the means, which would mean the statute doesn't apply.
I'm not sure that they're in an equal. I don't think that an equal inability to pay through income necessarily defeats a statutory award. His ability to pay is going to be through debt or liquidation of assets. And I think that that is still permissible under the statute. Is it reasonable to require him to do so? I think that is an issue for the court. I think this district court found that it was, given the facts of this case. It's essentially what I saw the court doing was adjusting the equalizer. In other words, the equity of the equalizer was being adjusted to allow her to afford her attorney's fees.
And that's the problem I think I see with it. That's exactly what I see, too. The district court said, you know, we're going to require an equalizer because it's appropriate that you each leave, in this case, with the same amount of property. But then the court took that away, took away from one party's property when the court said we're not going to apply a conduct-based approach. We're just going to look at a needs-based approach.
But I think I don't think it's unreasonable for the court to require husband to equitably adjust the equalizer to allow husband to pay for the fees. I think he can afford to do so. I think the statute permits it.
And he had his own fees as well, right? I mean, he was represented by counsel.
Presumably. Yeah,
you know, similar amount. Was he pro se for part of the case?
No, I think he was represented by counsel. Yeah. I don't recall the extent of his fees. I don't think they were as great as wife's, if I remember correctly.
Are they in the record?
I apologize, Your Honor. I would have to check.
I guess we don't have any case law with the sharing the pain being ascribed to lawyers.
Thank goodness.
If only the parties have to, well, yeah, unless you're the party. Well, thank you for your argument. I believe your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors.
Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Yes, sir. With regard to the matter of...
And now's your cue for your...
Sorry, name. Mark Gray, representing appellant, Aaron D. Luong.
Thank you.
Okay. The trial court, from the bench, you had a question about the trial court's determination of the wife's budget and whether or not the children's expenses, which I think counsel argued were part of this budget that he used in determining the amount of spousal maintenance. But in finding number 31 in his decree of dissolution, he states that she claimed a budget for herself and the children of $6,300 per month, which is a really high number relative to the only party's income at that time. But the court stated the court will not consider the children's expenses in her budget, as Mr. D. Luong pays child support for his share of the children's expenses. In addition, the judge said maintenance is for the support of the spouse, not for the children.
Well, and then in finding 33, when he took out the children's budget and her proposed budget was for $3,900 per month, something like that, and he then started removing items from that, like cable and those sorts of things, bringing it down to $2,900.
Exactly. The trial court did.
So the idea that the spousal maintenance award could be premised on the budget items for the children doesn't fly with what the trial court did. On the matter of attorney's fees, counsel, I believe, said something to the effect that the discovery process here required the expenditure of large amounts of attorney's fees by the respondent. The trial court made no determination of which, if any, fees, a subpoena fee or hours spent on finding things that he wasn't forthcoming about. And the trial court, I believe, said this is not a conduct-based award. It's a need-based award. So we don't get to the argument about how his conduct affected the award of $24,000 in attorney's fees. And there's no conduct during the litigation, as the court repeated, that would justify a conduct-based award of attorney's fees. And many of the expenditures...
Now, did the court say that, or did the court say it wasn't reaching the issue?
I believe it repeated language to the effect that the conduct toward conduct-based attorney's fees, there must be conduct during the litigation. And I believe he found that there wasn't conduct during the litigation that justified it. And the gambling losses sustained, he did not allocate into the marital property. He said those weren't in contemplation of the divorce. So I don't know how you get... What part of the $24,000 is related to her need to discover how much he had spent, which went nowhere with the court anyway, but the court never delineated from that $24,000 what was required to be spent by the attorney to gain information that she wasn't able to get without the expenditure of time. And I think counsel said that he might be able to finance the attorney's fees through debt acquiring more debt. And I'd hardly think there's a loan shark in town that would loan this gentleman any money, let alone a recognized bank.
There might be loan sharks that would loan him money.
Right, but in the end, they'd want blood from him or a limb or something, because he wouldn't be able to make payments on the loans. And 20-30% is a lot of interest to pay, but it just keeps accumulating it, and I don't believe that's realistic to say he can accumulate debt. In terms of liquid, him having the liquidity to pay $24,000 in attorney's fees, I don't know that a retirement account is a liquid asset with which he can just bill out a withdrawal slip.
The district court didn't actually require him to cut a check. The district court just reduced the equalizer amount that otherwise would have applied to your client. So there really is no, your argument about, well, can he take out a loan? There really is, we're not in that situation.
I agree. Not a good use of my time at argument, I guess. I apologize, Your Honor. I forgot about that detail. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you both for your argument. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you for coming today.